It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. A challenge to Wisconsin's abortion ban could be making its way to the state Supreme Court. The law was first passed in 1849 and went back into effect last June when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. In our series, How We Got Here, Abortion in Wisconsin Since 1849, WPR reporters explore how the ban came to be and how Wisconsinites have lived with and without it since. In part three, Sarah Lear and Rob Menser explain Wisconsin's path to legal abortion began with an arrest.
Here's what we know. On a Saturday in September 1969, a 23-year-old grad student walked into an office in downtown Milwaukee.
She paid Dr. Sidney Babbitts $900 in cash, and Babbitts gave her an abortion. Later, Babbitts took the elevator with the woman down to the lobby. A police officer was there waiting for them.
Michael McCann was Milwaukee County's newly elected district attorney.
A woman was stopped coming out of that office and inquired about whether she had an abortion, confirmed that she'd had an abortion, and I don't think she was ever charged.
She wasn't charged, but she appeared in a Milwaukee County courtroom that same afternoon. McCann needed the woman's testimony so he could get a search warrant for Babbitts' office. That allowed police to recover evidence and eventually to place Babbitts under arrest. In the court transcript, the woman initially declines to answer any questions. Then the judge gives her immunity from prosecution.
She describes how Babbitts used dilation and curettage to terminate her pregnancy at about 9 weeks. McCann, a lifelong Democrat, is now in his 80s. He's also a devout Catholic. He's open about how his faith informs his opposition to issues including abortion and capital punishment.
I have a deep respect for human life and a suspicion, without being a vast bench of history, that whenever human life is diminished, there's a price paid for it.
To McCann, the case seems straightforward. Wisconsin had banned abortions for more than 100 years, and he had evidence that Babbitts had performed an abortion.
But in the end, things got more complicated. Babbitts sued, and a panel of three federal judges took up the case. That forced the state to defend the abortion law itself.
The issue became, you know, what were her rights? Did she have a right to have an abortion? If she had a right to have an abortion, then Babbitts had not violated the law by giving her an abortion.
By the 1960s, campaigns to legalize abortion were growing all over the country. But historian Dave Garrow says they were mostly grassroots.
These local efforts were surprisingly uncoordinated at any national level or by any nationwide organization.
In Wisconsin, one of those local leaders was Edie Rhine. Today, Rhine is 89. In the late 60s, she was a stay-at-home mom living in suburban Whitefish Bay. She founded the Wisconsin Committee to Legalize Abortion and started speaking about the issue on radio and TV. That's how she gained a public profile.
I started getting phone calls from people asking if I knew where to get an abortion, and I didn't know. And then one day I got a phone call from somebody anonymous who gave me a phone number and said, you can give this phone number and people can get abortions.
When she was interviewed by the Milwaukee Sentinel in 1970, Rhine told a reporter she never told women how to do anything illegal. But that wasn't true. Rhine used to send women to Babbitts and other doctors, many of whom did abortions secretly.
I was on the telephone a lot. I was on the phone a lot. And my 9-year-old used to pick up on it, and she used to imitate me, and she'd say, how far along are you?
But the calls themselves were serious.
A lot of the women who called would say to me, I have so many kids, I can't deal with another one. And my husband will not use birth control. And, you know, they couldn't get birth control for themselves.
Birth control was illegal for unmarried women in Wisconsin. Often, even married women couldn't get it without their husband's permission. Garrow says abortions were relatively common at the time, even though prosecutions were rare.
As a general rule of thumb, only doctors whose medical practice left something to be desired, you know, resulting in injuries to a woman or in rare cases a fatality, generally only doctors who weren't at the top of the game were the ones who got into trouble.
During the 1960s, Garros's lawyers started seeing a new avenue to legalization. They pointed to the Supreme Court case Griswold v. Connecticut, which established a right to contraceptives for married couples. Attorneys used that same right to privacy to argue for abortion rights in cases including Babbitt's and eventually Roe.
Roe v. Wade was by no means a singular case. There were dozens and dozens of these cases, including Babbitt's from Wisconsin, from all around the country.
Ryan's group submitted an amicus brief in the Babbitt's case. It argued Wisconsin's abortion ban violated a woman's constitutional right to privacy. In 1970, the federal judges hearing the case agreed. They found that the right to privacy lasted up until quickening, or when a pregnant person feels fetal movement. That's usually about 4 months into pregnancy. The ruling effectively struck down part of the law that had been in place since the mid-19th century.
But initially, the judges did not order the state to stop prosecuting Babbitt's.
The case was tied up in appeals for years, and McCann and the state attorney general kept moving forward with attempts to bring Babbitt's to trial.
The ongoing proceedings created an environment of legal uncertainty. In 1971, a doctor named Alfred Kennan opened an abortion clinic in Madison. Just months after it opened, police searched the clinic, and the district attorney filed charges against Kennan.
That was a scary time. It felt like a police state or something, that the DA could raid a legal clinic and take all the records.
That's Annie Laurie Gaylor, who was 15 at the time of the raid. Gaylor's mom, Ann Nicole Gaylor, was a Madison-based activist who worked with Ryan.
Kennan's attorneys argued abortion had been legal in Wisconsin since the Babbitt's decision in 1970. And eventually, Kennan prevailed, though not before Gaylor's mother was subpoenaed by Wisconsin's Board of Medical Examiners about her work referring people to abortions.
Gaylor's now 67 years old, but she still has vivid memories of the attitude she encountered when she followed her mom around the country advocating for abortion rights.
I would often be left at a pro-choice table, and I was 13, 14, 15, and invariably some middle-aged or older man would come over indignant and say, if some 16-year-old tart goes out and gets herself pregnant, you know, she shouldn't be off the hook. She should have put an aspirin between her legs.
Decades later, Gaylor can't bring herself to read the Supreme Court's full decision overturning national protections for abortion. She worries that, in many ways, Wisconsin is heading back to the 60s.
Now, more than a year after Roe was overturned, Babbitt's may have new relevance. Wisconsin's attorney general references the Babbitt's case in an ongoing lawsuit. He's suing to block enforcement of the same 19th century law that led to Babbitt's arrest. Part of his case notes that in Babbitt's v. McCann, federal judges have already found that law to be unconstitutionally broad. He hopes judges toss out the state's near total ban on abortions, just like they did in 1970. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Rob Menser.
And I'm Sarah Lear.
And you can see more of WPR's series, How We Got Here, at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The play Mud Row confronts themes of class, race, love, and family bonds, and it hits the stage in Wisconsin as part of the lineup of the Milwaukee Black Theater Festival that's underway. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Marty Goebel is director of Mud Row. Marty, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, hey, good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So Mud Row, about two sisters really grappling with issues involving race and class, love, loss. Can you tell us more about the conflict between the sisters?
Sure. It's actually about a set of two sisters. So you have sisters that are in the 1950s and then sisters that are some 50, 60 years later. And it's about what the actions of the older pair of sisters what they do, how it affects the younger sisters later on. Yeah, it's a great play. It really is. Yeah.
The older sisters, Elsie, seeking social mobility, Frances being the civil rights activist. I wonder, how does that history take us more into the present day and what the two in the present day are experiencing?
Well, it's a really interesting thing because the sisters, the older pair of sisters, the one that's involved in social activism, it's pre-civil rights movement. So we see the beginning of the movement happening. And then her sister, Elsie, is really attached to the philosophy of the talent intent. And that is the notion that there are groups of African Americans, 10%, that have to bring the entire race forward and how they're navigating that. But when things happen to them and they don't necessarily reach their goals, they change as women. And so then Elsie has a daughter, and then we see her granddaughters and what they know of their grandmother, which is always fascinating to me. I know I have clear memories of my grandmother, but I don't know how she came to be the woman that she was. Mm. And so you see that journey happen within the play.
Can you share a bit about the playwright, Dominique Morisot, and the commentary that she puts into her works?
Yeah, she's fantastic. She's a very rhythmic playwright. So she often writes with the words that you would find in the African American population, but she structures them in such a way that you actually have an auditory spoken word sound within her text. I find this to be in all of her pieces. I've directed a couple of her pieces and performed in a couple of her pieces, and she's just fantastic. Really writes universal stories through the specific lens of the African American.
And you say you're continually on the lookout for projects that dissect society and issues that remain unresolved or rectified. How does Mudrow fit into that category?
Well, I think it's fascinating. We all come from families, no matter how fractured or cohesive they are. And the way in which she writes teases out just how repair or disrepair happens in the family. And so essentially, this is a family in conflict with itself. And because they're in conflict with themselves, it ends up being conflict with the community or within marriages or within the sisters' relationships within the text. I think that answers the question.
And
yeah,
it seems like there is the issue of the house, and that it's about the sibling relationship in the context of the family struggle over generations. And it's not just about keeping a house or a real estate transaction. That seems to be something that families grapple with is property.
Yeah, yeah. Who gets it? How it was obtained, do we keep it, what is the value, and does that value pass through the generations? And in discussing this within the context of the play, we're looking at gentrification. The modern sisters or the younger pair of sisters are, one is very dedicated to finances and has little connection, while the other one is finding emotional stability within the home. So it's a matter of the importance of this property and will it stay in the family? Can it stay in the family? And should it stay in the family?
We're talking about the play Mudrow. It's part of the Milwaukee Black Theater Festival. Marty Goebel with us is the play's director, and you can join in with your questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Marty, you've performed and directed plays across the nation. You teach theater at the university and the youth level. What surprises you most about directing this one, this play?
A lot of conversation has come up about familial relationships. And it has caused people within the play, not just the actors, but the production and design team, to analyze their personal relationships. And I'm often surprised at what people are willing to share. Yeah.
So I would imagine if that is coming up among the cast and crew, that audiences will have a similar experience after seeing it.
I hope so. And I hope that it will not only make people appreciate what they have, but maybe move towards resolution if there's conflict within their families. Yeah.
What is it like for you as a director, because Monroe transitions between those past and present events? How difficult is it switching from past to present on a live production?
You know, you'll see that I'm tinkering with the notion of what's real. So often the ghosts of the past or the older sisters are moving through the house as the younger sisters and their spouses are in the house. So it's really just pushing forward the notion that those that came before us are always here. And if you look deep into yourself, you can see your past, present, and even your future.
What did you think about as you worked to build the cast and the roles and who would play them? What were you looking for?
I was looking for people that could execute the text. It's tricky. And I was also looking for a group that I could make a family, that you wouldn't be shook in thinking, well, that can't be a sister or that can't be a grandmother. And then I was also looking for men that could be a wonderful representation of the most positive aspects of the African-American male. And so that's what I was looking for. And people that could hear my direction.
And then take it, I would imagine, too, because there is that feedback involved.
Yeah, there is feedback involved. I do believe that, you know, a director's job is to take the story, process the story, and come up with a vision for how it's to be presented. And you need people that are game for your vision, and that's what I have. Mm-hmm.
So Mudrow, part of the Milwaukee Black Theater Festival lineup, the 3-week event celebrating Black arts and culture. There's also a masterclass, plays, family night. How does this festival support Black artists in Milwaukee?
It gives them a platform to perform, to learn, to gather. And it's not just for Black people. It is rooted in the Black experience and us gathering and supporting the community. But it also is welcoming to anyone. Come and hang out with us. We're fun.
How is the theater community doing, coming out of the pandemic years?
I think the community is doing better than expected. We are certainly recognizing the need for storytelling and to have a reflection of ourselves on the stage. And I think that, you can't really kill a good thing. It will come back. And so, you know, have there been struggles? Yes, financial struggles, people often leaving the industry. But those hard and true appreciators of the theater arts are resilient, and we're still here, and we're still growing, and we're still here, essentially. That's the best way to say it. Yeah.
How have you stayed resilient? What have you had to do personally?
You know, I get this question often, and I never know how to answer this, because I am one of the lucky few that didn't see a change in my workload. And I have a great family life. And so we were happy to be in the house together and explore what that meant to be just isolated in that way. So I didn't have the struggles that so many did. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot more people like me that it didn't knock us down. It was a shift in how we approached our day to day. But I didn't really struggle during the pandemic. I I don't know if I should have shame with that, but it's the truth. So,
Marty, as part of the festival, you're teaching a play development workshop and a master class, and you say that full body expression and movement are important for Black actors and actresses. Why is that?
Because we are a group of people that come from a rhythmic existence, and the drum and the calls that we have always had within our community before we even came to this country are still present. And I think often when you move through theater in other cultural communities, that there is an unwitting push to take that out of us. And I think that Black folks, we move, we shake, we always have, through marches, through migration, through dance, through spiritual appreciation, and pushing that forward for the African American community and allowing that to shine on stage is of the utmost importance for me.
We're going to circle back to Mud Row. What do you hope the audience takes away from the play after tomorrow's first performance?
That often you're speaking to people in your family that may rub you the wrong way or may in your eyes have fractured particular things. And if you go back to the beginning, if you study, if you research, if you speak with those people, where they were coming from, the time they were born, then often a lot of things can be explained. I know my grandmother was born in 1912 in South Carolina, and often some of the things that she would do coming out of the Depression and living in kind of a rural area would just baffle me. But as an adult woman, I can go, of course that makes sense. Of course that makes sense. So having conversations with those that came before us, that are still here, and that we're blessed to speak with, and finding out what makes them tick, why they got here, is only going to be healthy for the individual themselves.
Marty, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Marty Goebel is director of the play Mud Row. It's part of the Milwaukee Black Theater Festival, which starts today. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about a Madison Cafe owner.
Patrick Downey opened The Victory on Madison's east side in 2010 after moving the cafe from Brooklyn. WPR's Alyssa Alamand frequents The Victory and spoke with Downey about the community he's fostered at the cafe through his sarcastic yet welcoming personality.
The reason I opened a coffee shop is that I needed a job I couldn't quit. I was almost 40, and I thought, it's cute when you're quitting all these jobs, but when you're 40, it's just like, what's wrong with this guy? So I got a job I couldn't quit, and I haven't, even though the early days in Brooklyn were like rough. Really, 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 really rough. I'm Patrick Downey. I'm the proprietor of The Victory, located in Madison. Well, I was in New York for 26 years, starting in 1983 and ending in 2009 when, for kid-raising purposes, I relocated to Madison with my wife. We were advised to look on the east side by people that we knew in Madison, so I saw this space on Craigslist when I still lived in Brooklyn, and I really liked the windows. And since I knew I would be here a lot, I wanted it to be a space that I liked looking at. Like, this is where I spend most of my life. And oftentimes I think people feel like the time that they spend getting their coffee should get subtracted out of their life because it it isn't worth as much as like the time they spend doing something meaningful.
With a shot of lavender.
You got it.
I would say that 90% of the people that come here very regularly. In Brooklyn, if you liked my shop, I would see you every day until you moved out of the neighborhood. Madison is a little bit different because people have cars, but a lot of people come here every day.
How are you guys doing?
I mean, from a basic, let's not kid ourselves level, it means that we're still open and I'm paying my bills and feeding my kids, etc. So the fact that the people that like it really like it is probably the difference between having to get a job and being able to keep doing this. I actually feel very strongly that in my case, I do in fact put my money where my mouth is in terms of really trying to build a sense of community here so that if you come in here, you know I know you. Like, I don't pretend I don't remember your order. I don't pretend I don't know your name.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
My name is Andrea Gonzalez-Paul. I used to work here. Patrick's the coolest. And so is the Victory. I think, like, you've had a lot of really cool people come through here. And it's just like a Madison, what do you call it? Staple. Yes, I view the Victory as a Madison staple.
It didn't occur to me until I came to Madison that, like, the people that came didn't just spend money. They showed me a great deal of love. I really value that. Like, I like that people come here and feel that it gives them something more than just me being a human coffee vending machine. If you come through the door of my shop, I have an almost pathological need to make you happy. I would explain to people that everything is all about me here. Like, it's my own little world. It's a little tiny world. It's not even, it's like 14 seats legally, but it's my little world, and that's fine.
WPR's Alyssa Alamand brought us that story on Patrick Downey, owner of The Victory. This story was produced in collaboration with Tone Madison, an independent website covering culture and politics in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A UW-Milwaukee project documents the connections area residents have with access to food and how they view their lives as hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites face hunger. That's according to Feeding America. UW-Milwaukee's Story Cart is an actual cart with audio equipment setting up in places to start conversations with strangers. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nicole Welk-Yeager is Deputy Director of the Center for 21st Century Studies at UW-Milwaukee, working on its Story Cart project. Nicole, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having us.
Well, by the numbers, you have more than 8 hours of audio stories from people in the Milwaukee area talking about their food journeys, stories ranging from 3 minutes to 20 minutes, the age range all over the place, 4-year-olds to 80-year-old. What are you learning from these stories?
Oh, we're learning a lot. So some of the things that we're learning is that people have to go to multiple places to be able to most adequately get their food. The first question we ask them is, where do you most commonly gather your food? And more frequently than not, it's not one answer. People are answering with multiple locations, and there's multiple ways that they get to those locations. And then when we're talking about food connections and issues of food and trust, one of the questions we ask is, if you think of trust as a concept, what's a food or recipe that comes to mind? Those answers are really, really incredible and speak to the various different cultures and communities that make up the Milwaukee region.
So you've asked participants, these strangers, with a microphone in front of them, you know, when you think of trust, what is a taste or recipe that comes to mind? What are you hoping to learn from that question?
I think there are a few things that we hope to learn. These are questions that are based on, they're called sensory story prompts. Hmm. This is coming out of a tradition from Anne Bastings, Beautiful Questions. She's part of Time Slips and has really focused on questions that invite performance and maybe gets people to think outside of the box a little bit. And what's interesting about that question, I think, is we're really been exploring if food is the thing that connects us, if we're going to combat things like loneliness and isolation, if we're going to combat things like hunger, or we'll be talking a lot about civic engagement and trust in the coming years with the story cart. What's the thing that connects us, and is trust the thing that helps connect us, and is food the thing that does this? And so that question, when we're asking, when you think of trust, what's a food or recipe that comes to mind? I think it speaks to people's personal connections, how they build trust with family, how they build trust with strangers or with institutions or organizations like universities. And some of the answers have been quite conceptual, not just thinking about a specific recipe like my grandmother's soup or pasta, or even thinking of macaroni and cheese, but also thinking conceptually. We've had answers like transparency and accountability. And I think that those are really important answers for us to explore a little bit more and think about a little bit more when we're thinking about that concept.
It's a big question for someone who is just walking up to you and having to think through a question like that. It's interesting what comes top of mind. And I'm wondering what you think of this approach to talking with strangers as part of, you know, some bigger research concepts.
Yeah, I think one of the things we're trying to do at the center is we've been very academic and university focused for quite some time. And with the story cart, we're trying to invite everyone to the table to these conversations. And sometimes it's the top of mind that we're most interested in. Our mission at the Center for 21st Century Studies is to build a community of scholars to address the pressing issues of our time. I say that a million times a day, so I kind of have that motto in my brain. But the notion of a scholar, I mean, everyone has these experiences and data in their back pocket, so to speak, through how they live their life. And so I think asking people kind of sometimes quite randomly these types of questions, it helps get a sense of, this is the lived experience. This is how people are thinking about these issues in the moment. And those are really important to keep in mind when we're thinking about these larger research topics.
Let's listen to one lived experience. This is Katrina about traveling from Milwaukee to neighboring Waukesha to buy food.
I'm scared about buying my foods here in our community because they sell us below market and aftermarket and disgusting stuff that I don't want to eat and put in my body. I try to be healthy a little bit, but...
How often are people expressing negative relationships with food?
It's actually quite frequent. It's been quite surprising. And sometimes this comes up when we ask people where do they most commonly gather their food? And just to preface, we've visited over 23 different sites across Milwaukee, including some block parties that have been hosted by food pantries or service community partnerships, as well as, so Katrina's interview was actually at Fondy Food Market, where we had that recording made in early July. And so when we ask people where they commonly gather their food, they're often at the farmer's market, and they'll say something like, oh, I don't know if I totally trust grocery stores. And I've been to some grocery stores where I've had spoiled food. We recently had some interviews where we got to the trust question, trust in food, and people went on concerned about chemicals and concerned about not just health and freshness in food, but actually what is in the food and how the food is being produced. And there's quite a disconnection that we're seeing in those answers. So I would say probably a good 30-40% of our interviews, and we've done over 150 of them, people are voicing concerns about their food.
You and the team plan to create this publicly available database with the stories and information from the StoryCart project. So with Katrina being an example, how would Katrina's story be used by researchers or artists?
We actually are leaving that up to the community. So we're trying to make this project as open and as collaborative as possible. So when we we're building the database right now. It looks like it's going to be on an Omeka-esque platform if anyone out there is interested in digital humanities work. But what it's going to have is all of the audio, the written transcripts, and any images, pictures of the individuals if they gave us permissions to link up with their audio clips. And what we're inviting researchers and different organizations like Milwaukee Public Libraries is one partnership we have. We also have a partnership with the Milwaukee Food Council. They can use these stories to activate existing data. There's a lot of data out there about food access and food insecurity. There's a lot of data out there about distrust and trust in food, as well as some incredible initiatives going on in Milwaukee trying to address these issues. And so our hope is with that open access platform that people can use the data in any way that they see fit and hopefully find a story or an image or some information that might help them better activate the things that they already know. And so it's quite open, it's quite collaborative, and we are working with two artist organizations, and they're hoping to really highlight the beautiful stories that are coming out of this collection, because we not only ask about where people are gathering food, how they get there, and food and trust, but we're also asking about what food is meaningful to them, and also what a dream garden plot look like. And so it's not just about addressing the issue, it's also thinking about solutions and maybe reimagining our food systems that's coming out of those stories.
Nicole Welkjager, Deputy Director of the Center for 21st Century Studies at UW-Milwaukee, working on its story cart that seeks to document stories of Milwaukee area residents. Call in with a question, add a comment along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a story experience program underway in Milwaukee County called StoryCart, striking up conversations with strangers to reflect on how food connects us to other issues. Be part of this conversation at any point. Call in with a question, share your experience at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Deputy Director of the Center for 21st Century Studies at UW-Milwaukee, Nicole Welkjager, is part of the StoryCart project and stays with us. Nicole, you mentioned solutions to food insecurity. What ideas have surfaced from these interviews about local solutions?
Yeah, I think that there are a few solutions that are coming out of this project, and this is the larger network of participants in the project, and participants, I mean, the hosts and the organizations, as well as what people are voicing in these stories. And the three that are really top of mind for me are very local grocery stores, and grocery stores being part of the solution. The other is community gardens or urban farms being part of that as well. And then also continuing to support food pantries or food centers and trying to reimagine what a food pantry might look like. And these are hyper-localized, sometimes block-for-block relationships that we're seeing, and people are engaging with these various different factors or different organizations and institutions in different ways.
All three of these things you mentioned, they exist in our Wisconsin. But when you say
Absolutely.
Very, very local grocery stores, what do you mean by that? And what is the role there?
I think the important thing is using that data I was talking about, this data that exists of seeing where there are food deserts, where we're seeing examples of food apartheid, and where we're seeing blocks and blocks of there's not a easy available, easy access to affordable, fresh, high quality foods, fresh fruits or vegetables. There are a lot of these pockets in Milwaukee. And so I know that one of the places that we went to, they celebrated their first anniversary as a grocery store in one of these pockets. They started it at Sherman Park Grocery Store. And so they were committed after hearing all of these hearing sessions that this was a want of the community to have a grocery store, not just a gas station, for food access issues. And so that's what I'm talking more about, is seeing where we need these to be placed. Where does a community garden need to be placed, a grocery store or a food pantry or food center? The location is really important, especially as we're addressing transportation issues that can become quite dicey when we, especially when we get to the winter time.
Speaking of Sherman Park Grocery Store, let's hear from Maurice responding to the question, when you think of trust, what is a food that comes to mind?
My mama's macaroni and cheese. I trust her because she put love in it. And that's what we're doing here at Sherman Park Grocery Store. You might consider it an entity or a business, but it's not a business. We're not just a grocery store. We're building community here. We're creating or putting the neighboring back in the hood, if you will.
So Maurice said the grocery store filling a gap in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood. How is this grocery store different from others?
It's different in a few ways. So that was Maurice Wentz. He is the owner with his family of this grocery store. They are committed to fresh fruits and vegetables in a way that is unprecedented in some ways. They have a hydroponics garden that's in the facility. They also are really trying their best to find other resources to be able to help particularly single parent homes get the fresh fruits and staples that are needed. And so he's been working with a few nonprofit organizations to get donations so that they can give out these $50 cards that are to the grocery store so that people can commit to buying fresh fruit, vegetables, as well as eggs and dairy if needed for their homes. And so that's what makes them special. They also are really focused on issues of sustainability and food sovereignty and collaboration within community. So hiring people within Sherman Park to work the grocery store and also really listening to their neighbors as to what is needed when moving forward and thinking about the growth of that space.
Nicole Welk-Yeager, Deputy Director of the Center for 21st Century Studies at UW-Milwaukee, overseeing its StoryCart project. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's hear from Alex about being a restaurant owner in the Milwaukee area.
A food that's special to me is probably sticky rice. Being Laos, I know everyone eats sticky rice in Asia or in Southeast Asia, but you know, they say if 85% of your diet is sticky rice, you're probably Lao. But, you know, growing up eating it, it was like our daily bread.
Alex, connecting food to culture, place, religion, how connected are food and culture? What did you hear?
Oh, we heard a lot, especially in the meaningful food, but also in that trust question. When people thought about the taste of trust, they often went back to their heritage roots. There was one person that we interviewed on Southside, and they talked about, when I think of taste and trust, I think of Mexican, and I think of peppers, and I think of spice. Some people have gone so far as to talk about like the various different tonal qualities of the taste of trust, and it has to do with their mixed cultural heritage. So there's something there about celebrating who you are and celebrating who you love through food that I think is so important for us to recognize and to listen in these stories.
Nicole, we only have a few moments left here, but do you think the StoryCart concept might change the way historians or sociologists do research?
I think that in ways it's already happening. We have the National StoryCorps program that works with the Library of Congress to collect stories. I think what's different here is that we're hyper-focused on Milwaukee and the Milwaukee region. Another thing that's different is that we focus on a prompt mm-hmm. and circulate that prompt each year and have community partners talking directly to academics. So I think this is community engaged research in a different way.
Okay.
This has been happening in other spaces, but this hopefully with the story database that people can feel open to using these stories, and not just in the academic or university space, but also for their personal interest and use too.
Nicole Welk-Yeager, Deputy Director of UW-Milwaukee's Center for 21st Century Studies. We have linked to StoryCart, wpr.org/mornings. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network.